Mr. Vice President, you certainly need no introduction to members of this mission, nor indeed to any American citizen. This is not only because of your great achievements as a public servant, but because throughout your life, you have to an uncommon degree exhibited a compassion for your fellow man, a concern for their welfare and their well-being. And so you have been in the forefront of all the great movements which have brought about the continuing revolution which has taken place in the United States in the past 30 years. You have possessed also, to an unusual degree, the gift of being able to communicate your concern to others, and so have not only commanded their affection, their esteem and respect for your accomplishments, but their affection and confidence as well. It's because of this feeling of confidence and trust you have been able to inspire that your talents have had such wide scope and such effective employment. But it is not only the domestic scene with which you have been and are concerned. You saw very clearly from the first, after the Second World War, that the United States could not live to itself alone, that we could not expect to live in a peaceful world that existed half prosperous, half in poverty and misery. And you saw equally clearly that we could not have that kind of peaceful world we envisage unless the United States was willing to make and keep commitments to that world. It is because of that conviction that we know, Mr. Vice President, that you have given, are giving, such unwavering support to what we are endeavoring to do here, to make it possible for people freely to choose the kind of government under which they wish to live, to help them build a viable economy and political institutions suited to their own needs and genius, to carry out a social revolution in the midst of war, to make credible our commitments under the Charter of the United Nations and the CETO Treaty, to make possible, when peace is restored, regional economic development and mutual cooperation among the nations of this area, and to keep the door open always to an honorable, just, and durable peace. In pursuing these ends here, Mr. Vice President, your support, the strength of your convictions, which you have expressed so articulately and forcibly, has given us encouragement, has given each one of us renewed courage and determination to get on with the job, new confidence that we shall achieve our purposes and objectives. And so, Mr. Vice President, on behalf of all of us who are serving here, as an old friend, on behalf of all your friends here, I express to you our gratitude and extend to you a very warm and a very affectionate welcome.
Thank you, Ambassador Bunker. Ambassador Locke and General Westmoreland, my fellow Americans, both in the military services and the civilian service, and any of our friends and neighbors of the Republic of Vietnam or other countries that may be in this audience today. First, let me express to you, Ambassador Bunker, and to all of you, my very great happiness in being able to come back for a second time to Vietnam. I wanted very much to make this journey and to be here for this historic and momentous occasion of the inaugural of an elected president and vice president, of an elected Senate, and of a lower house. I believe that this is a very important day in the life of free men and free nations, and indeed of free Asia. And I wouldn't want to miss it. I'm the sort of person that likes to be where the action is, and I surely like to be where history is being made. I've been here, as I said, on two occasions. I've been here, as I said, on two occasions, and maybe as one that comes so infrequently and from such a distance, I am better able to see what has happened in those months of less than 2 years than some of you that have been here for an extended period of time. Some people can never see the forest for the trees. Some people can never really recognize progress because they have been so much a part of it. And there are others that never can recognize progress because they really don't believe in it. Well, I have had the unique privilege of being here in February 1966, immediately after the Honolulu Conference, having listened to the promises that were made in Honolulu, the commitments that were then given to the people of Vietnam as well as to the people of the United States. I came here only about a year after, less than a year after the armed forces of the United States came here in any number. And I can say this morning that the progress militarily, politically, economically, socially, is remarkable. It is something that the people of Vietnam ought to hold with great pride, and that you as Americans ought to feel a sense of pride about, because you've had something to do in shaping that progress. Now let me be very frank with you. I know there are many limitations. I don't need to remind you of them. You're reminded of them every day. I know there are many shortcomings. I need not tell you of those. There are experts in shortcomings. I know there are many disappointments. Nor do I need to describe them, because there are some people who are never so happy as when they're unhappy, or particularly when they can describe unhappiness for their happiness to make you unhappy. So I'm fully aware of all of these things. I've lived some 56 years now, and I've been in public life for almost a quarter of a century, 25 years. I think I know something of the joys of victory and of the pain of defeat. I know something of the disappointments that come. And let me tell you, I also know something of the exhilaration and the inspiration that comes from some success and progress. Now, I ought to share with you a very intimate observation. I come from your capital, Washington, D.C. I am your vice president. Some of you assented to that, others did not. I'm not so sure which of you paid me the greatest favor. But in Washington, I had to make a decision as to whether or not I'd be a pessimist or an optimist. And I took a good look at the headcount, the fields of competition. And I found so many people crowding into that vast area of pessimism that it looked like you'd have to be an awfully good pessimist to even get recognition as a pessimist. There were so many. So then I looked off in the broad plains of optimism, and there was hardly anybody there. And since I'm a Midwesterner and like room in which to roam, and knowing that if there are not too many around, the competition is not too difficult, I decided to be an optimist. It's been so joyful. There are so few of us. And not only that, when you act optimistic, there are on occasions people wonder about you. But let me tell you why I'm an optimist. Because I'm an American. The whole history of our country is the proof of the right of a man to be optimistic. You see, I'm one of those Americans who does not believe that the success of the United States, politically, economically, culturally, socially, that success is the result of and the sum total of failures. I don't think it came about because men in government and business and labor, in education, the professions, in religion, were all wrong or were fools. I think that America is the greatest success story that the world has ever known. And so if I seem to be a bit optimistic about our commitments and about what we do, I'll only say this, that I spent several years of my life as a teacher, professor, and student. And my course of study was in government and history. And I think that my history lessons taught me that we have a right to assume that if we put ourselves to the task, that success will crown our efforts. I believe it was Thomas Huxley who said in substance once that he knew, speaking of America, that he knew that our nation was rich, he knew that it was powerful, he knew that it was big. But he said that greatness is not riches or power or size. Greatness is what do you do with these things? What are we going to do with our power, with our wealth, with our size, with our position in the world? What will we do with it? And I think that the commitment of the United States to this part of the world is an indication of what we are doing with it. And I want to talk to you about it in the few minutes that are mine here today. Now, I should let you in on a secret. I have some notes here, but my friends of the media know that those seldom mean very much. I generally make two speeches, one that I have here and one that I decide on making as we go along. But it's my way of living and it's my life. And I decided a long time ago to live it as I wanted to. First, I want to bring to the American military forces the gratitude, the respect, and the admiration of your president and your vice president and your fellow Americans. And through you, General Westmoreland, I ask that you convey to every man and every officer in the field and in your command, in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, every branch of our military, I ask that you convey our deep gratitude and appreciation for service beyond the call of duty. And let it be known from this platform that the men and the women of the armed forces of the United States today represent the finest generation of Americans that this nation has ever known. This is the testimony of the officers who are in command. And so when I read of the limitations of our young people these days, I'm reminded of what men who command them tell us. Remember, these young Americans that are here in battle are your brothers and they are your neighbors from back home. They are the same Americans that you see back in your hometown. And they're doing a mighty good job adjusting themselves to a new and strange environment, to all of the difficulties of climate and terrain, facing problems that they never dreamed ever existed. And yet I think it's fair to say that we've never put a better defense force in the field. Never have men worn the uniform of the United States of America who have done a better job as soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen and Coast Guardsmen than those that are here today serving in this struggle as an ally to the Republic of Vietnam. I'm proud of them. The President is proud of them. And I want them to know that we are humbly grateful. And then let me say through Ambassador Bunker and Ambassador Locke that those of the civilian community in the Republic of Vietnam, those Americans of the civilian community, those of you that I see before me and many more, that you have the gratitude and the appreciation and the admiration of your president President Johnson and your vice president and your fellow Americans, we know that this is not an easy assignment, but we know that you're doing it well. And whatever you may read about disagreements at home concerning our effort here, I think that you should know that the American people in the vast majority are proud of you and what you are doing. The American people know that your task is not easy. And I might add that disagreement back home is not an unusual development, nor is it unique in the history of America when it is engaged in struggle. If there are two things that characterize America in war, it is disagreement and valor. Disagreement and heroism. And yet, with all of that disagreement, a basic sense of loyalty to the country and to its cause. We do not fight wars to deny ourselves freedom. The task of a free government is to place as few limitations as possible upon a free people, even as we are compelled by circumstances to engage in battle. You should also know that your president and your vice president are fully committed to you and what you're doing. And I mean this to our military and our civilian forces here. And you should know that we are committed to our commitment to peace and to security in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Now, that word commitment is a precious word. It is a very, very important word. It does not mean that we have a casual concern. It does not mean that what we're doing is just something that we thought maybe we ought to do. The word commitment means what our forefathers said: our lives, our fortunes, our sacred honor. That is the definition of commitment. And when I say that we have a commitment to peace and security and to freedom in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, I mean it just as I have described it. And then, too, you should know this, that we are committed to lasting it out. And we are committed to a new era of freedom and progress in Southeast Asia, indeed, the world over. I want my message today to be one of reconciliation and of peace. We seek nobody's territory. We seek to destroy no nation or regime. The policy of President Lyndon Johnson, the policy of the government of the United States, is one of reconciliation with all peoples, to live in peace, to live in peaceful competition. And that statement applies to nations in Asia and Europe, in Africa, in Latin America, everywhere. It applies to the Soviet Union. It applies to Communist China. We seek not war, but understanding and peace. We seek not to exacerbate differences, but rather to reconcile peoples and differences. Now, let me assure you, military and civilian alike, that the sacrifices that you're making for your country, and I know full well the pain of separation from family and the ever-present physical danger for many of you, are recognized by your fellow Americans and are appreciated and respected. And I particularly say this to the people of the military. It is a very difficult ordeal. But can I say that I know that this is the least complaining segment of our national life? the least complaining. When I left El Paso, Texas, here just 2 or 3 days ago, there were a number of the families, wives and children of our servicemen here. Not one of them complained to the Vice President, and I talked to every one of them personally. Not one of them said, "I wish my husband wasn't there." Not one. Only one came to me and said, "Mr. Vice President, my husband is missing in action. If you could get any information about him, I'd appreciate it." That was the only word of concern, or should I put it, the only word that I heard other than, "I'm proud that my husband is there." And many of those wives told me that their husbands had re-enlisted, had gone back for a second tour of duty. I submit to you that that is the voice of America. That is the real spirit of America. The voice of America are not those angry voices that are heard above the hard work and the sacrifice of the American people, those angry voices of ugly dissent. But the voice of America is the tear in the eyes of a woman whose husband is here. The children who ask about their daddy. That's the real voice of America and the real spirit. And that is what the world needs to know. The world does not need to be told of our bad habits. They're quite obvious. But it needs to know of our basic spiritual, political commitment to the cause of freedom and human decency. Now, you're not just working and fighting for our allies, the people of the Republic of Vietnam. Although I might add that is a worthy cause in itself, and I wouldn't want to underestimate it. You are really here working to protect the ultimate freedom and security of the people of the United States. I say this because freedom cannot live in isolation. Fortress America is not a sensible defense policy. Freedom requires an environment of freedom, an environment of hope, and a condition of peace. So when we stand here in Vietnam, we do it in the name of the United States, in all that it stands for. Now, there are those who cannot remember the threatening days of the 1930s, when the democracies failed to act, and the seeds were sown for World War II. But I remember, and your president remembers those days. They were days of shame for many peoples and nations. There are those who cannot remember how many times since World War II we've had to face up to subversion and aggression in Europe, in Asia, in the Caribbean, and by so doing, how we have maintained the peace and prevented World War III. And where the prevention of World War III is our business. This is the most important business that we have. I was reminded just last week that in your country there are 27 million veterans living who have worn the uniform of the United States. And there are 5 million wounded. And needless to say, hundreds of thousands of brave young men who lost their lives. Our cemeteries are filled with them. This is the commitment that America has made to peace, to freedom. And when our critics seem to belittle us, I often want to tell them, what is it that we have taken? Who is it that we have despoiled? Who is it that we seek to rule? Why is it that you feel that somehow America is bad or evil? America has been in two world wars. It has fought in Korea. It has faced communist expansionism in Europe and Asia. And America has yet to take one inch of territory. Rather, it has given people their freedom who justly deserved it. It has not sought to impose its will on one country. It has poured forth its treasure in unbelievable amounts. And yet we have those today who would lead the world to believe that we have evil designs. We have those in our own midst who would lead you to believe that. And we have far too many who have forgotten the lessons of the 30s, who have forgotten that in appeasement there is no peace, who have forgotten, if you please, that if you are to be free, you must be brave. There are those who cannot understand that the American commitment to the people of Southeast Asia is no less firm than our commitment to the people of Europe. I understand this under my obligation as Vice President. The President of the United States understands it under his obligation as Commander-in-Chief. There are those who do not understand that in this nuclear age, this dangerous age, that aggression unchecked in one place can threaten the peace of nations in many places. This is why we take our stand now. I understand this. I think you understand it. And that's why you are here. And I believe, frankly, that most Americans understand it. The innate good sense and fundamental courage of the American people are the strongest weapons that we have. They simply want to know that what we are doing must be done. They call upon you to help lead them in a better understanding of this period of human history. Now, once more, let me make this clear. Your president and your vice president recognize the nature of the struggle here. We know that once again we are being tested. We know that this is a different war. This is not conventional warfare. We know that this struggle is not only military, but it is political, psychological, economic, social. And we know that every part of it is equally important. Once again, the aggressor is trying to find out if we have the will, the determination, the courage to stop him. We have to make up our mind whether the law of the jungle will be the law of nations or whether there will be law and order under the Charter of the United Nations. And may I say that despite public opinion polls, none of which, may I say, have ever been very friendly towards a nation's commitment in battle, despite criticism, despite understandable impatience, we mean to stick it out until aggression is turned back and until a just and honorable peace can be achieved, until the job is done. That is the policy of the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, and the Congress of the United States. So let people understand it. I think that you need to know this, and I say that it is imperative that our adversaries should know it. They must never underestimate our will. The greatest disservice to the cause of peace in the world today is to deceive the enemy into believing that America is so disunited that it cannot stand it, last it out. And I must say with equal emphasis that disunity at home only feeds the ambitions of the enemy abroad. I am convinced in my own heart and mind that if we could unite as a people, submerging some of our differences over tactics, that we could shorten this war that we would save lives, that the adversary and the enemy would soon understand that he can neither win the war in Vietnam or in the United States, that he cannot win at any place, and that he must come to terms, cease his aggression, either come to the conference of negotiation and have an honorable settlement, or to retire from the battlefield. That is the contribution that we could make to peace. So have faith. Be resolute. Stick to your task. And neither think nor talk weakness. Neither think nor talk doubt. Neither think, talk, nor act with indecision. You know why you're here. Let every movement of your body, every word of your mouth, every thought of your mind, every prayer of your spirit indicate unmistakably that you are here because you know it is right to be here, and that we intend to stay here until freedom and independence for this country is assured. And the sooner that people understand that, the sooner the blessed day of peace will be ours. I know that the task is hard that I've asked you to undertake. But let me say this, if the task is hard, if the going is rough, you should know that it has been this way before. Do you think it was easy for the British after Dunkirk? And there were wise men who said then that Hitler had won, that the British were through. Do you think it was easy for the Americans after Pearl Harbor? There were even those then that cried out for a quick peace. It has never been easy. Do you think it was easy for George Washington at Valley Forge, with his armies deserting, with his Continental Congress unwilling to even send food or supplies? Do you think it was easy for Abraham Lincoln, even in 1864, when it appeared that his armies would be defeated, when he knew not whom he could trust? It's never been easy. It was not easy for Woodrow Wilson, who found a Congress against him, even in the draft, or for Franklin Roosevelt. And it never was easy for Harry Truman in Korea. I sat alongside of the Prime Minister of Korea today. And all the time that I was there, running through my mind was that public opinion poll of January 20th, 1951. George Gallup, Princeton, New Jersey, which said, the question, should we withdraw from Korea? 66% of the Americans said yes. Only 4 months before, 80% said we should stay. But in the intervening period, we had lost battles. The powerful forces had joined the North Koreans and had driven us back almost into the ocean. And there was a public opinion in America that said we should withdraw. What do you think Korea would have been today? There had been no free representative of a free Korea at this inaugural. And my fellow Americans, today, Korea represents one of the great success stories of Asia. And as an American, I'm proud, proud as can be, that we've had something to do in the birth of a free nation of Korea. Very proud of it. Just as proud, may I say, as Lafayette must have had in the birth of America and the others who came to our rescue in those early days. And I might add, as I speak of this history, and I've done it before, my fellow Americans, patriots, one and all, we didn't win our freedom without help either. At the Battle of Yorktown, there were more French than there were Americans. And more French died than Americans. And the fleet that bottled up the British was French, not American. And Cornwallis surrendered not because of our power alone, because of an ally called France. Just remember that. We've had dark days, but we've come through them. So we're going to build. We're going to protect. We're going to help the people of this land create strong and responsive democratic institutions. And we're going to be steadfast in the work of nation building. I saw nation building this morning. I thought it was a marvelous ceremony. That magnificent inaugural address of President Chu, it was a great address, a commitment to his people. He said to the people, I am yours. I am your servant. Now, this is a commitment. We're not sure whether all of this will succeed. I know there will be the cynics. But my fellow Americans, we weren't sure that it would succeed when we started either. And I would remind you that even in the earliest days of our republic, there was secession. I would remind you that there were traitors. I would remind you of a Benedict Arnold and an Aaron Burr. I would remind you that it was not easy. But I'm happy that I, as Vice President of the United States, could be here to represent our country on the day that a nation, a free nation, was born. And we're going to try to help nourish that nation into maturity. You see, our business is nation building. The work of health, of agriculture, of education, of economic development, and of political development. We are builders, not destroyers. We want to be known as teachers, not lawyers. We want to save life, not take it. And that's why we're here. And above all, we're making our stand for people, for the people. Everything about America is we the people. We the people of these United States. A government of the people, by the people, for the people. Not a government of the elite, of the nobles, but of the people. And we're here taking our stand for people. I saw some of them yesterday in the Revolutionary Development Training Center. Simple people, very much like the people that made America. And we're here for ordinary people, for the young people, for farmers and for workers. And we're here for programs to help them get their honest chance in life. And let me tell you, we're going to succeed. We do not admit defeat. We are going to succeed because they want to succeed. We're not trying to have a Vietnam that's stamped made in the USA. We want a Vietnam that is known, Vietnam, made in Vietnam by the Vietnamese. And if there is a footnote, that it had a faithful ally and friend, the United States of America. That's all that we ask, and that's all that we should expect. So finally, let me leave you with this. I believe that when the history of this period is written, Vietnam may well be marked as the time and the place where men finally learned the lessons of the past. The lesson that the aggressor must be checked before it is too late. The lesson that there is no peace with appeasement. That there is no freedom in weakness. And that there is no security in isolation. I'm sure that Vietnam will be marked as the time and the place where peace was preserved. Because peace has to be fought for, just as everything else worthwhile has to be sacrificed for. I believe that Vietnam will be marked as the place and the time and the place where the family of man gained the time it needed to finally break through to a new era of hope and human development and justice. This is the chance that we have. This is our great adventure, and a wonderful one it is. And you are the Americans that are making that history. And our business is to make history. I've said from many a platform, it's all right to study it, and I did. It's all right to teach it, and I have. But it's wonderful to make it. Make history your own way in your own time. And let the chapter of history of this last third of the 20th century read like this about our America, that without regard to race, color, creed, or region, Americans at home and abroad took their stand for freedom and for opportunity. That is the good news of the last third of the 20th century. We have grown up. We recognize that we're all God's children, that the differences of color and race and creed and region are minimal and really unimportant. What is important is that we are people. And I think it will be to the everlasting glory of this nation, the United States, that not only were we willing to fight for our friends and neighbors in Europe, from whence our relatives came, in which our bloodline is found, and from which our culture came, but we were also willing to take our stand in a faraway place where the names were difficult to pronounce, where the cultures were different, but where there were people, plain people, ordinary people, good people, and that America and Americans united with them for their freedom, for their independence, and for their hope. That's why I'm happy to be here, and I hope you are too. Thank you very much. Mr. Vice President and men of the armed forces of the United States and the Republic of Vietnam, our other allies in this great struggle, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Vice President, I've been doing far too much speech making, and I shall not keep you long this morning. My first thought is, sir, to express once again to you as the Vice President of the Republic of Vietnam and to President Chu, our deep appreciation for all of the hospitality and courtesy that has been extended to me as a representative of the government of the United States at the inaugural ceremonies. This is a very momentous occasion for all of us. I wanted to come to Vietnam once again to see the birth of this new republic, to see the new government come into being after a painful and yet a very successful process of the development of constitutional government. I might say to my fellow Americans that seldom in the history of the world has a nation been born with constitutional government during a period of war. Generally, that development of representative government follows a struggle rather than being created during the struggle. The people of Vietnam are to be complimented for their very singularly important and their significant achievement. I know that I speak for the Ambassador of the United States, Ambassador Bunker, one of our most distinguished and beloved and respected public servants, when I say to everyone gathered here, well done. You surely have represented our country in Vietnam with great honor, courage, valor, distinction. We're proud of you, very, very proud of you. And I know that I speak for General Westmoreland and the other officers of the American command when I say that the troops that are here bearing the uniform of the United States are the finest troops that this nation has ever known. This is a fact that is recognized at home and abroad. So I compliment you. I ask my fellow Americans to keep in mind that everything that we do, everything we say in this country reflects on our country. Try to conduct yourself in a manner that would bring honor and credit to you in your own home. Remember that we are here to help, as you know, and we are here to be friends, as you know. I know that you do treat the people of this country with respect, and it will be showered back upon us in may I say, in large measure in the days to come. I want to just conclude with a note that I scratched out here last night. I want to read a few lines of a verse, simple and direct, yet written from the heart of an American soldier who came to respect and love this nation during his service here. And here's what he wrote. I see a nation growing, growing out of a war, fighting for its freedom, a nation born of sorrow, a nation born of grief, a nation that I'll be proud to say tomorrow that I saw born today. That's great poetry, but more significantly, it's great history. And I think it tells what's happened here. There is a nation being born. And be understanding. It doesn't come easy. It takes time to build a nation. It takes time to build an army. It takes time to build leadership. It takes time to win. And the only limitation upon us is if we seem to weary or if in any way we become impatient. Let us not become impatient. Let's remember that it took better than 200 years to build what we have in the United States. Let's be patient with ourselves and patient with our allies. And let's let the enemy know that no matter how long it takes, what price we have to pay, that we will be here, that they cannot win. I want every American to stand a little taller. I want every American to express by his walk, his talk, his actions, his demeanor, confidence without arrogance, to be resolute and firm without being belligerent and bellicose, to be desirous of peace without being weak or seeming to appease, to be courageous and brave without braggadocio or without being one that seems to offend others. All of this we can do, and I know all of it we will do. Mr. Vice President, I was out at the Revolutionary Development Training Center, and I listened to the young men out there sing. And by the way, gentlemen, I want to say this is one of the most inspiring experiences of my visit in Vietnam, to see the young men from the countryside being trained for leadership. That's the way America grew. It didn't grow from on top, it grew from the bottom. Those of you around me here, you come from humble homes, and yet you're the best that the world has to offer. It's out of this humility, out of this simplicity, yes, out of this ordinary life that great people and great nations come. And here's what the Revolutionary Cadre song says. And my, what a stirring message it is for all of us. Let's go forward. Let's move ahead. Let's resolve to build up our countryside. Let's get on with the job. Together we will develop this great land of Vietnam. Now those are words that any American can embrace. And this is what makes us kindred souls and brothers in battle, as well as brothers in peace. I want you to know that your president is proud of you. I bring you the greetings of the Commander-in-Chief. But more than that, I bring you the good wishes of the people of the United States. Do not be disturbed or dismayed by the loud voices of a few. The American nation is with you. And the American nation will not let you down. And I want to say to the people of Vietnam that we won't let you down either. We'll be here until the job is done. And when the job is done, it'll be your country, not ours, for you to take care of, for you to love. Mr. Vice President, thank you very, very much. And may your service be one of success and prosperity. And may victory crown your efforts and ours. Thank you very much.